They did not have the information they needed to make a decision and to recognize that the tsunami was coming.
Indonesia's tsunami might have been less deadly. It's Monday, October 1st. This is VOA Asia. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Hello and welcome. You'll find us as well on Facebook at VOA Asia. Also ahead, the toll of banning pro-democracy in Hong Kong, India's new personal freedoms, technology to keep free speech free, a raging Supreme Court battle, and Vietnamese beer. It's all on today's VOA Asia. The death toll from the earthquake tsunami disaster in Indonesia has more than doubled, rising over 830 with 540 injured people, according to Indonesian officials. Authorities have said they expect the death toll to rise. Indonesian President Joko Widodo arrived Sunday in the city of Palu, one of the places devastated by an earthquake and subsequent tsunami, to personally survey the destruction. He addressed the troops deployed to the area and asked them to be ready to work day and night. Almost 17,000 people have sought refuge in 24 shelters, according to the National Disaster Mitigation Agency. Vice President Jusuf Kalla predicted that the death toll could reach into the thousands, since officials had trouble relaying information from remote areas because of downed power lines. Louise Comfort, a professor at the University of Pittsburgh Graduate School, is the principal investigator of the U.S. National Science Foundation into early tsunami detection in Indonesia. She tells VOA Asia's Ira Melman that a system that could have saved lives in this case was not in place.
This is particularly painful for me because the tsunami early detection system we have been working on for 5 years now, actually going back to the 2004 tsunami, is in its prototype stage. And just last week, we were told it was put on hold. This is a system that relies on ocean bottom units on the ocean floor that pick up the movement of the water, changes in the water column that indicate a tsunami. This method of detection is much more accurate and more timely than the system that was available, you know, in the last few days. Unfortunately, the Indonesians had to rely on the land-based seismic sensor system, which indicated the earthquake, but they had only the GPS observational units, or I'm not even certain they had GPS units in Palu, tide gauges, which are basically observation of movement of the water. So they did not have the information they needed to make a decision and to recognize that the tsunami was coming in Palu.
As far as you know, why was it placed on hold?
Regrettably, I as far as I know, and it's hard to say, there was a devaluation of the Indonesian currency this summer, and the finance ministry had allocated the funds for this prototype. But in the allocation, the devaluation made less money available. So BPPT, the Marine Survey Agency, was worried about starting the deployment of the prototype and not having sufficient funds to complete it.
How much money was Indonesia expected to put up for this?
Well, the overall amount was about $150,000. And the amount of that was allocated was just under $100,000. So what BPPT was worried about with the devaluation of the currency was about $50,000.
And that's all it would have taken to save how many lives?
Over 400. And counting. I mean, the death toll is almost certain to rise.
What would have happened had the system been up and running?
Had the system been up and running, they would have picked up immediately from the ocean floor the change in the water column. And that would have been transmitted via acoustic communication to the shore station and transmitted to BMKG. What was missing for BMKG, and the reason they pulled back the warning, is they had no direct measurement of changes in the water column.
How do you feel about this? Are you angry? Are you upset? How do you feel about this?
I am profoundly disappointed, because we have the technology. We have also Indonesian researchers who have been working valiantly for 10 years trying to get a system like this in place. And the difficulty is no single agency or researcher can do it alone. It requires a collaborative commitment to solve this problem of early tsunami detection.
Is there any criminality here? Just decisions that have been made?
I don't think there's criminality involved. You know, I think they're trying to do the right thing, but it's short-term versus long-term thinking, literally. And the sobering part is the scientists know that tsunamis are going to happen in Indonesia, if not this year, then next. If not next, then the year following. So now Indonesia is, you know, 18,000 islands located right on the Ring of Fire. And it's a very vulnerable region. What is fundamentally disappointing is that international agencies are willing to help. Tsunamis happen not only in Indonesia, but around the world, and certainly in the U.S. as well. And so the National Science Foundation allocated this project $3 million to work with Indonesians and to test this prototype to see if it could work and be available to other nations, New Zealand, Chile, India, Thailand, that also experience tsunamis. But it's particularly urgent, I think, for Indonesia because they are more vulnerable than most nations. And it's, you know, if it works in Indonesia, it's going to work anywhere.
Louise Comfort says a larger international effort is needed to place the latest technology in place to more closely detect future tsunamis. These are among some of the top Asia stories you'll currently find on voanews.com. Indonesia death toll jumps above 830. Typhoon pummels Japan, flights canceled, train shut down. North Korea says it will not denuclearize before more trust in the United States. Fearing a debt trap, Pakistan rethinks Chinese Silk Road projects. U.S. bases on Okinawa, focus of Japan election. Expanded coverage of these stories and much more are on Facebook at VOA Asia. Also stop by our voanews.com website. Continue with VOA Asia. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. The group Human Rights Watch has warned that the decision to ban the pro-independence Hong Kong National Party is a grim sign for human rights in the Chinese territory. It is the first time a political party has been prohibited since Hong Kong returned to Chinese control in 1997. Felix Patrickief is president of the Australian Institute for International Affairs and a longtime Hong Kong watcher. He tells VOA's Victor Beattie it goes against the long-standing so-called one country, two systems principle, which has allowed the financial hub a high degree of autonomy and freedom not found in the rest of China.
It's really a further tightening of the grip by the People's Republic of China on the internal freedoms that Hong Kong was assured of in the joint declaration in 1997. So 21 years later, we've had really the overstepping by Chinese influence on something that's absolutely axiomatic to a free society, and that is freedom of speech, freedom to express political ideas and positions.
What was the justification given, Felix?
It might lead to forms of violence or unrest. might being the operative word. The Hong Kong National Party is actually a very peaceful group. They do demonstrate, they do raise placards, and they do mention the idea of an independent Hong Kong, which is absolutely anathema to China. But they don't do very much else. In fact, they don't practice any violence whatsoever. So this is just a ruse and a way of actually getting around the idea of having a free Hong Kong.
This is just another drip, 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 is it not, in the process of ending freedoms on what used to be a British colony?
Absolutely. I remember having an interview with you about a year ago when Carrie Lam came into the chief executive's position in Hong Kong, and I was looking forward to seeing what she was actually going to do and whether she was going to open up the system a bit more. Unfortunately, it's gone in reverse. Carrie Lam has turned out to be really an unreliable protector of freedoms in Hong Kong. They opened a Kowloon West railway station that houses fast trains to China. That million square meter area has been handed over to China. It becomes Chinese territory, in effect, at $1,000 Hong Kong a year. And that was done under a sort of veiled secrecy, which Carrie Lam has resisted calling that, but it is. So lots of things are happening which are really concealed and which make it very difficult to actually practice any form of transparent thinking.
Felix Patrick Keefe said while Hong Kong will likely retain its role as a key Asian financial capital, growing restrictions will, in his words, politically emasculate the people. Happening now in Asia, a powerful typhoon ripped through Japan Sunday, forcing cancellations of flights and trains, including in the Tokyo area, as authorities warned of strong winds and torrential rain. National broadcaster NHK reports so far the storm has injured at least 51 people in southern Japan. Stay up to date with VOA. You're listening to VOA Asia. We're glad to have you with us as we start out a brand new week on VOA Asia. A landmark ruling earlier this month that overturned a ban on gay sex in India has overjoyed the LGBT community, but the road ahead in building societal acceptance will be long and difficult in a largely conservative country. As Anjana Pasricha finds out, some activists are making a beginning in schools and colleges where the subject is mostly taboo.
Away from their enthusiastic participation in annual gay pride marches, India's LGBT community struggles to find safe spaces from a young age.
But when it comes to the student community, they're still living in a very backdated time. And, you know, they call us names, they tease us, they bully us.
As efforts to change those attitudes gain momentum after the Supreme Court legalized gay sex, a packed audience turns up for a workshop on gender and sexuality at the Indraprastha College for Women in Delhi University. Undergraduate student Lakshita Jain says the ruling has facilitated more open discussions on LGBT issues.
They need to be aware of it, maybe because they've been confused about themselves or they need to accept others. So I think it's very crucial because this is something that nobody talks about at home or not even at school. So in the college atmosphere, it is very important, you know, because this is the time when you discover yourself.
The two-hour session is animated as students raise questions and listen attentively on the right to gender choices that may not conform to existing societal norms. Rituparna Bora of Nazaria, a queer feminist group that organized the workshop, says grassroots change is crucial.
I think things will be much better when they grow up. That's what we feel. And that's why we aim at schools and colleges.
The legal battle to lift the criminal tag off gay sex took nearly two decades. The struggle to change mindsets will also be long, but the journey has begun. Anjana Pasricha for VOA News, New Delhi.
Coming up, technology to keep journalism uncensored. You're listening to VOA Asia.
News is mobile and so are you. Get VOA on the go. Get VOA on Google Currents. Get VOA News specifically made for your tablet and smartphone. Clean, simple, fast. Now available for Android or Apple phones or tablets. Download the Google Currents app for free today. Get VOA on Google Currents at voanews.com/currents.
This news from VOA Asia, growth in China's manufacturing sector cooled more sharply than expected in September, suggesting U.S. trade tariffs are starting to deal a heavier blow to the world's second largest economy. The official Purchasing Managers Index fell to a 7-month low, but remained above the mark that separates growth from contraction. Grow your news awareness with a visit to VOA Asia Facebook. As VOA Asia continues, according to a latest report by the Committee to Protect Journalists in Pakistan, fatal violence against journalists has declined, but fear and self-censorship has grown. In this era of self-forced censorship, 5 Pakistani-American students at Harvard University have created a startup which challenges censorship using the latest blockchain technology. Their mission is making journalism truly free. Saqib Islam visited Harvard's Innovation Lab to bring us the story of a new company called Encrypt.
Growing up in Pakistan, Ali Chaudhry and his peers experienced a curated version of the world outside.
And we've seen censorship firsthand, and we've seen how it affects lives, how it affects the whole society.
Chaudhry says that he was raised in an environment where a video sharing website, such as YouTube, is blocked by the government is common. But after moving to the United States, he realized just how valuable having access to information really is. To do something about it, Chaudhry and few of his friends at Harvard University founded Encrypt.
Encrypt is based on a simple yet powerful principle that open access to authentic information is the bedrock of a free society.
To make this idea of censorship-free information for all possible, Encrypt uses the latest blockchain technology, where users can exchange content without passing through any server.
It is a censorship-resistant platform for publishing, not just for journalists, but also for all types of media.
Chaudhry describes blockchain technology as the backbone of Encrypt's ecosystem, a peer-to-peer network based on an algorithm
that ensures trust, there is no hacking, and it's immutable, so nobody can change it, intercept it in between.
The 5 co-founders of Encrypt are all from Pakistan. They say that building this technology at Harvard University's Innovation Lab gives them the advantage of having access to necessary resources.
With that, we gained recognition from many different organizations.
Encrypt has already been launched in the United States, Canada, Germany, and China. But the founders' ultimate goal is to be available in countries where it is really needed. Saqib Islam, VOA News, Boston.
This news from VOA Asia, Russia and China have called on the UN Security Council to ease international sanctions on North Korea as an incentive for it to denuclearize. This position clashes directly with the U.S. stance laid out by Secretary of State Mike Pompeo, a policy of maximum pressure that has led to diplomatic breakthroughs. All the big stories come your way through the day on VOA Asia Facebook. This is VOA Asia. Now on VOA Asia, we turn to U.S. politics and a story that has been prominent in front of the world as President Donald Trump's Supreme Court nominee Brett Kavanaugh moved one step closer to confirmation Friday when he won a party-line endorsement from the Republican-led Senate Judiciary Committee. A new element of uncertainty was introduced when one Republican senator insisted on a 1-week delay in the final Senate vote, until the FBI can investigate an allegation of sexual assault brought by California professor Christine Blasey Ford. VOA National Correspondent Jim Malone has the latest for us.
Mr. Graham, Mr. Cornyn, Mr. Lee.
On a party line voice vote, Republicans prevailed in sending Judge Kavanaugh's nomination to the full Senate for a vote. But Republican Senator Jeff Flake said he would support Kavanaugh only if the full Senate held off voting on his nomination for a week to give the FBI time to probe a sexual assault allegation brought by California professor Christine Blasey Ford.
This country's being ripped apart here, and we've got to make sure that we do due diligence. I think this committee has done a good job, but I do think that we can have a short pause and make sure that the FBI can investigate.
Democrats have been pushing for an FBI investigation of Ford's allegation, which dates back 36 years and which Kavanaugh has denied. Both offered riveting and emotional testimony on Thursday. Democrat Chris Coons worked with Flake on the proposed compromise.
That we can both show respect for victims who have come forward with allegations and give Judge Kavanaugh some prospect of his name being cleared in some ways before a final vote.
At the White House, President Donald Trump said he was impressed with the previous day's testimony from both Ford and Kavanaugh. Most Republicans remain committed to pushing ahead with Kavanaugh's confirmation, but Democrats like Senator Amy Klobuchar demanded the FBI investigate Ford's allegation. The emotional fallout from Thursday's testimony from Ford and Kavanaugh was evident during the Friday hearing. There were more protests Friday, both in the halls of Congress and on the steps of the Supreme Court, proof that Kavanaugh's nomination continues to galvanize a politically polarized nation. Jim Malone, VOA News, Washington.
Anh Bui and his siblings emigrated to the United States from Vietnam in the late 1980s, and several years later, his parents followed them to Richmond, Virginia. VOA's Hung Le visited the family's restaurant, which helped make their adopted city one of the nation's ultimate destinations for beer lovers.
Drink, drink!
Birthday boy.
It's great!
For some beer drinkers in Richmond, it's the best beer house in town.
I come here because the staff is awesome, the beer is awesome, and On is awesome. And they do probably more different stuff than any other brewery in the country.
The credit belongs to this man, beer master and beer lover Anh Bui, who discovered American beers didn't seem to pair well with the Vietnamese dishes at his family's restaurant.
In the past, to me, American beer tastes very bitter, sometimes a bit pungent, and I didn't like it. Belgian beer, however, is sweeter and sour. So the restaurant began to sell Belgian beer or German beer, which goes well with Vietnamese food, which is fresh and is also sweet and sour. That's why the new restaurant succeeded and gained its reputation.
With a stock of distinctive Belgium and German beers, Anh attracted local beer nerds. They spread the word. Today, he has more than 50 beers on tap. The Mekong restaurant has been named Best American Beer Bar twice. Richmond, once known for a high murder rate, now has 35 breweries and a hip reputation that's drawing new businesses and residents.
Did I think that the city would ever appear on America's beer map? This was my dream.
Every month, Richmond's brewers gather at the Mekong because they all benefited from Anh's expertise.
I built and supported the beer community. For example, anytime people who like to drink beer want to know how to make beer themselves, I always have time to help them learn and I share with them.
Anh recently opened a brewery he called The Answer. Anh says there's a simple reason for the name, because when Anh and his family decided to make America their new home, the question was how, and the answer was beer. For Hung Lai in Richmond, Virginia, Long Nguyen, VOA News.
You've been listening to VOA Asia. You'll find us online. Stream our program from VOA Asia Facebook or our website at voanews.com, or you can download it as well from either of those places or iTunes and SoundCloud. We'd also like to thank everyone listening on the radio. Voice of Chung Rung, Star Radio FM 88.3 at Chung Rung Christian University in Tainan, Taiwan. Thanks for tuning in today. Our thanks always go out to Director Tracy Carter and our engineer Zineb Abdel-Rahman, Managing Editor Diane Gao, and our VOA Asia team, including Skylar Ogden, Ira Melman, and Doug Bernard. I'm Jim Stevenson. We're in Washington. Have a terrific day.